Deborah Chiraza, who is the new CEO at Otway Health. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
I'm very well.
Good. Now, what's your story has got nothing to do with, well, it's got a little bit to do with your job maybe, but it starts where you started. Where did you begin? Where were you? Where did you come forth into the planet?
I was born in Leonora, Western Australia.
Okay.
In a mining town, Leonora, as it was, fairly well known in its heyday.
Mm.
Not much there anymore. Don't even think the birth records at the hospital exist anymore. Yeah, interesting tale.
So you're one of many, or...?
No. Firstborn child to a man named Mori, an Italian immigrant, who was a young man, landed on the shores of Western Australia after he'd run away from Italy and met a young Aussie woman who'd run away from east coast of Australia, from Victoria. They met in Western Australia and commenced their relationship, and I was the result of that relationship.
And the only, that was it?
No, two more sisters.
Okay.
After about 6 or 7 weeks as a baby, I was 6 or 7 weeks old, I understand the story is I was wrapped up in a bundle and put into a flower box inside a banana crate and put on the train with my mother and father. And they came across the Nullarbor to Victoria to live with an Italian family in Altona.
Right.
As many, many Italian immigrants of that era and time in the 50s, they would all connect up with each other. Their networks would get together. So my parents came over to live with a family for a short while. And then just before I turned approximately two, I think, my parents moved down to Gippsland to the... there used to be a lot of timber mills down in the part of Gippsland they moved to. And then my two sisters were consequently born in the town of Hayfield, which now isn't much of a town either. So three girls.
And you grew up in your early years in Hayfield?
Yes, started primary school in Hayfield. And then when I was about 8 or 9, my parents moved back up to the eastern suburbs of Melbourne, back to closer to where my grandfather was. My mother wanted to reconnect with her family back up in Melbourne. And then the rest of primary school and high school was in that area. So I went to Lilydale High School.
All right.
Finished high school at Lilydale, and then it was a bit of a wild teenager and moved into the city to the likes of Carlton, South Melbourne, those sort of areas for a while.
Okay. So we're all good young Melbourneites and Italians especially, kick over the traces a bit. So did you get on well with your mum and dad?
Yeah, my memories of Hayfield were particularly close and family orientated. I remember things like coming home from school and mum being there and making hot chocolate drinks for us, and she would have knitted doll's clothes for our dollies while we were at school, and those sorts of memories were very simple. I remember Dad being quite a character. He was to my memory, he was the only Italian, the only immigrant in the town at that time. Lots and lots of white Anglo-Saxon Aussie type families around us. Then when we moved up to the city, to the suburbs, life changed. Both my parents started working. Dad had two jobs, mum had a job. Life became very different, very busy. And then towards the end of my high school years, my parents separated. So life became different again.
Okay.
So they reconciled a couple of times, but then eventually divorced. So life changed.
So a couple of things about that. First of all, as the only Italian in the small town, did you get any flack?
Not in the country town, but in the suburbs we did.
Ah, okay.
I do remember once I went to high school, I didn't like to acknowledge my heritage. I was, for my teenage years, I really, really didn't like being known as the Italian at school. And there were lots of other names that are politically incorrect these days that we were referred to and called. And I can remember things happening where, you know, Dad would get called names and we'd be called certain names as kids. And there was a degree of cultural Italianness about our family. My mum became a very Italian-like woman, being married to an Italian man. And I can remember my nonna coming out from Italy for a while, and there was lots of pasta and salami and lots of, you know, salamis hanging in the back shed, and Dad getting together with local farmers from the hills around the suburbs where we lived and making lots of Italian-type food. So there was an era of I didn't want to be known as an Italian at all.
Okay.
And it wasn't until I did the Aussie backpacking thing, went off to the old Europe backpacking trip thing that we all seemed to do in that era, and I really identified then with my whole Italianness and really came back feeling quite proud of my Italian heritage, to the point now where I like to be known to my grandchildren as Nonna.
Sure, that's lovely. Yeah. So do you think then that your mum and dad embraced that whole Italian stuff as a bit of a retreat from the slings and arrows of less enlightened white Australians, or do you think they would have done that? That was part of their life.
No, that was just who they were. That was their DNA.
Yeah, yeah. So tomatoes in the backyard.
Yeah. It was just that. That's what Dad knew.
Yeah.
I think my mum probably struggled. In hindsight, now looking back, I think Mum probably had a bit more of a struggle with it. I think she wanted to be the good Italian wife and the good mother, but at the same time, she was a white Anglo-Saxon third generation Aussie.
Yeah.
And then certainly as us girls got older, and now looking back again in hindsight, as their relationship started to deteriorate, I think it became a bit challenging in some ways. Because your DNA is your DNA.
Yep.
You know, there are times where I'm very excited about things and very Italian and very passionate about things. I can't help that. That's my DNA.
Yeah.
You know, it's in your blood.
So you went to Lilydale High School.
Mm-hmm.
And about this time your parents' marriage is dissolving.
Mm-hmm.
How did that feel? How did you feel about that?
That's a really good question. I don't know that I've reflected on it that much. Perhaps at the time then, I just thought, well, if they weren't happy, they shouldn't be together. I think it was harder for my sisters. They were younger.
So you were 15, 16?
Yeah. I think as the eldest child as well, there'd perhaps been lots of time. You know, I was the eldest sister, so I needed to look after the younger sisters and look after the girls. And, Deborah, you do that because you need to. You're the grown-up sister. You need to do that with your sisters. So for me, it perhaps wasn't as traumatic as what I think now it was for my two sisters. I think they perhaps took on a lot more of the emotional baggage of it than I did. I just kind of thought, well, if they weren't happy, they were better off apart.
Yeah.
So I'm very pragmatic about those sorts of things. So interesting times. And I also was a little bit wild and was quite happy to kind of go and do my own thing. I left home for the first time in my leaving year of high school. I was living away with another family because it was what I wanted to do. So I guess I was kind of a bit independent in many ways. And
So this was more freedom for you.
Yeah.
I was less surveillance.
I was quite happy to kind of mosey on and do my own thing, really.
And was your dad a typically conservative Italian dad? Did he expect to review the young suitors who were no doubt turning up at the doorstep and things? Or
no, the young suitors never appeared on the doorstep until after my dad was kind of away from that paternal role. He certainly, as a young kid and in my early teens, absolutely. I often think that the reason my two sisters and I didn't stray too far from home until we were in our mid-teens or later teens was because we were actually quite intimidated by the rule of the Italian father.
Okay.
And interestingly enough, now, as an old man, he's such a mellow old Italian man, but certainly as young kids, we thought he was fierce. We thought he was pretty strong and he ruled with an iron fist. many ways now. I don't think he really did. But, yeah, we certainly had some indoctrination of the way things. And it was interesting, Bob, I find that a really good question, because when I went to Italy and stayed with my nonna, it gave me so much insight into the way my dad ticked and the way he worked. So it made me understand a lot more about his cultural background. Sure. Yeah. And that's what influenced him to be the man that he was. Mm. Not that I particularly like some of those traits and some of those things, but it was in Italy, that's the way it was.
Well, yeah. That's right. It's much easier to understand what's...
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember meeting my father's sister and you know, as a grown man and getting some idea of who he was for the first time, really. Who really was. So you were 17. Did the boys get in the way of the education or?
No. I was the ugly duckling. I was the only girl at school that didn't have boyfriends. They came to my house because they were able to hang out because by that stage the rules in our house were pretty relaxed because Mum and Dad were doing their own thing and perhaps weren't around as much. And so the guys hung out at my place, not because they were interested in me. It was just that they could hang out there.
Okay.
I didn't actually have my first boyfriend until after I left school.
All right.
Okay. So.
And you did well at school?
I did all right.
Yeah.
I wasn't a particularly studious type of high school student, but I got by.
Yep.
And I was a bit street smart and I was a bit, I was probably bright. I think my personality probably got me through a lot as well. Now, in hindsight, again, that wonderful thing, hindsight, if I actually had have applied myself, I probably would have got really, really good marks. But I got by without having to do much effort and much work.
Yeah, well, you might have ended up running an organisation somewhere.
Well, yeah, I could have ended up as a CEO one day when I grow up. But anyway, yeah, I interesting.
So,
how you look
so
back.
Who was the first young fellow with the great good sense to ask the ugly duckling out then?
It's a boy named David, who I went to school with, actually.
Yeah.
And that was just a bit of a short-term fling.
Mm-hmm.
And then my first serious relationship was with a guy who I met in my first job, first paid job when I left school. And that was a 7-year relationship, and he was considerably older than me.
Yeah.
Anyway, that ended itself and ran its course in my early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
So I was about 16 and a half when I met him, and that's sort of ended when I was about 23 and a half.
So what sort of workplace was it? What were you doing?
Well, my very, very first job when I left school, I hadn't told Mum and Dad that I'd actually left school and I thought, well, I'll go home and tell them when I've got a job. So I got a job a couple of days after I left school because in my matriculation year, it was annoying me. I decided I didn't want to be there anymore. I got a job that I thought was a laboratory assistant in a pharmaceutical company. When I actually got there, I was counting tablets into little brown jars. Well, let me tell you, 3 days in, I just thought, this ain't for me. This is actually just working in a factory. Not liking this very much at all. So I went home and fessed up that I'd left school and went to a recruitment agency a couple of days later and got an office job and worked in an office job in a car yard, in a panel shop in a car yard in South Melbourne. And that's where I met the boyfriend, the partner.
Mm.
And, so a few months in, set up home with him. And had a job, and then somewhere along the line, I met a lady named Pam. I have no idea where I met Pam, but I do know that she had an impact on me in that she talked to me about always being able to support myself and look after myself and not ever being dependent on anyone else. The other thing that Pam did was gave me a copy of the book The Prophet by Cahill Guy Brand.
Yep.
And I still have that book
and
the inscription from Pam is in that book. I have no idea where Pam came from, what became of her, but I know that she had an impact on me.
Mm.
And somewhere along the line I thought I really need to do something that's going to give me some form of training or education and also give me an income. And at that time you either got scholarships to do teaching or you went nursing.
Mm.
And so on the spur of the moment I went nursing.
Okay.
So another turn that I didn't expect.
So this was while you were still in the relationship?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So suddenly you've moved from just a young lady doing a job and I assume, you know, going out and having fun and doing domestic stuff and to someone who's got a bit of a career of your own.
Well, yeah, I probably wouldn't have thought about it as ambition at the time, but it obviously was. And started my nursing training, realising that that would give me a qualification. Mm. So started my nursing training at the Royal Children's Hospital. And in those days, you needed to do 3 years and 9 months to actually get your nurse's qualification in the Children's Hospital because you had to do adult training at another hospital. In those days, you could also, at the end of the first 12 months, you could register as a nurse's aide. A nurse's aide, I think we were called in those days. And about 2 years in, one night on night duty again, a bit flighty, and thought, this is actually giving me the irrits as well, being on night duty. Mm. And the relationship was a bit unstable and a bit rocky, and I thought, this is giving me the irrits too. Had my 21st, and I thought... I was nursing and thought, I really want to go overseas. I'm going to get out of this racket that I'm in at the moment. I'm going to work hard and long and make money quickly. So quit my nursing training, became a nursing aide, started working in aged care, saved up money really fast, had my 21st, got some money for my 21st and took off backpacking around Europe.
Wow. Leaving goodbye Bill or George.
Yeah,
or
yeah,
Fred,
good, goodbye, yeah. Goodbye man, that you're not meeting my needs because you don't respect me enough to actually understand that I'm much better than you, but
well,
that's okay.
well, to be fair though, you had met before you had discovered your mission to be independent, the need
right.
in you to be independent, and so you essentially grew apart.
Well... Not quite. Not quite. Took off with the backpack and thinking that I was going to do Europe for 2 years and work over there. 9 months in, I got the marriage proposal.
Oh,
come
really?
Home.
Come home, I want to marry
come
you.
Come home, I want to marry you.
Can't live without you.
Can't live without you. Apparently. Mm. So he thought until I got home. And then.
So you responded in the affirmative. You thought,
yeah.
Wow.
Well, yeah. No, actually, he probably suggested that to me when I'd been away about 4 months. Mm. I waited until 8 months to decide to come home. Mm. And then I came home at the 9 month mark. And by the time I got home, I'd recognised some familiar traits that I thought, if we don't get married within 3 months, we never will. Mm. And it probably won't go very far. What I predicted was what happened. We didn't get married. The relationship fell apart. In actual fact, he nicked off with another woman and I was left thinking, why did I come back?
Wow, gee. Mm.
So in that time frame, I thought, right, this is never going to happen to me again.
Right.
And so at the age of 23, as a mature age student, yep. I went back and did my nursing training again.
Yep.
Because by that stage, I'd recognised that I actually really liked that whole notion of being in a profession that was about caring and being with people. Mm. I'm an outgoing person. I like people. I'm a people person. So the nursing was the idea. So I started looking around to see where I could get back in and do my training and see if I could start where I'd left off. That wasn't going to happen. So I was accepted to do my nursing training either at Deniliquin or Echuca Hospitals. I was back in Melbourne.
Yep.
And I thought, I could go country. I grew up in rural. I kind of like the idea of country. And the starting date at Deniliquin was before the starting date at Echuca. So I packed up in my little red Datsun Bluebird and I hit the road and I went to Deniliquin. And was a turning point. Best 3 years, had a great time, loved my nursing training in a country hospital, loved living in Denny, had a most fantastic social life in Denny, met some amazing people, did some great stuff, tasted my first beer in Denny.
Okay.
And, decided I'd head back to the city. And in just before I'd left, oh no, somewhere around my 20s, early 20s, I'd met two very, very influential people in my life. My first best friend, a guy called Andrew, and my other best friend, a lady called Jules, and Jules now lives in England, and they were both from the country as well, and they became very significant others in my life. And so for the next decade, there was lots and lots of life that was lived with Jules had moved on and gone to England, and Andrew and I were hanging around a lot when I went back to Melbourne. While I was in Denny, I knew Andrew and saw him a lot down in Melbourne. He became a really great mate and we were inseparable. And when I got back to Melbourne for the next decade, I did a lot of courses, did my worked in operating theatres, then I worked in ICU, and then I went and did my midwifery. Mm-hmm. And, shared lots of living with Andrew.
So it was very much a career focus. Did you go to the theatre? Did you go to rock concerts? Did you sit on the bank of the Yarra? I mean,
we were at opening night of the Rocky Horror Show when they were showing it in Melbourne, and we got filmed on the Mike Walsh Show. We went to the theatre. We partied. We did clubs.
You were out and about.
Yeah. In our late 20s and early 30s, we just had a great time. It was a great time to be alive and be young and to be out there having good times.
Mm. Yep.
We were having fun.
So now you've turned into almost a matron by now. You're 30, 28, something or other.
Matronly as in age,
in qualifications. you're single.
Oh, no. I was single, yeah, and having a great time. And
so you're living by yourself?
Mainly sharing houses, shared houses. Moved into a shared house in Fitzroy in the mid-80s, and that was a great time, a great place to live. Mm. Lots of art, culture, galleries, food, the tapestry revolution up Victoria Street, Johnson Street happened, lots and lots of lots of fun times.
So other nurses you're living with?
Sometimes, sharing with other nurses.
You came and went a bit.
Different people sharing with. Mm. In the mid-80s, I became very, very passionate about women's health and very involved in midwifery, became a midwife and absolutely found my clinical thing that was the best thing I ever did as a clinician. I loved being with women and babies and that whole birthing story.
So you were part of that whole birthing centre thing that was happening around
very
that
much.
Time?
Yes, very much in that whole birth centre revolution and home birthing and working independently and had my own midwifery practice for quite some time, met lots and lots of amazing women, was very politically active around women's rights and birth rights and having a baby and women being able to make their own decisions and control their own birthing experience and their own bodies and their own health issues. So that was all through the 80s and early 90s and became very, very, very focused on wanting women to be able to have the right to stand up and make their own choices. So somewhere along the line, I thought that the way that I could I really wanted to change the world by this stage, and I thought that the way I could do it through women's health and women's birthing rights was to teach people about women having babies. So I took myself off and got a teacher's qualification and became very involved in the education aspect of health delivery and healthcare and nursing and midwifery, and became a midwifery teacher. And now this has taken us up into the 90s. And for the first time, something happened that people didn't think would ever happen. And nurses started to be retrenched through the health system in Victoria. And nursing education had moved into the whole education sphere of universities. Mm. Nurses were getting degrees and the switch from hospital training had gone to the university sector. And postgraduate education for nurses and midwives and health professionals and especially nurses had moved into the uni sector as well. So there was no job for me anymore in the uni sector, in the health sector. And So I thought, I think I need to take some breathing space, and what will I do next? And I was retrenched from my job in a major teaching hospital in Melbourne.
Yep.
And I saw a job advertised in the pre-hospital emergency sector, in the ambulance sector, and they had a job for a teacher to teach ambos in childbirth, emergency childbirth.
Yep.
So I thought, that'll be a nice little reprieve for a few months. So I was offered that job and accepted it and moved from mainstream health into the ambulance sector, went there for a four-month gig and ended up staying there for 6 years. Okay. And guess what happened in that time?
Well, it would take the patience of an ambulance man.
One night, I think.
He was your student, was he?
No.
No.
I was his boss.
Oh, right.
So in the mid-90s, I was I started off on a short-term contract and teaching ambulance in the undergraduate program. Then I moved into teaching and managing the intensive care ambulance and flight and air wing ambulance programs, and started managing those programs working in the ambulance training centre. And through that era in the 90s, they were bringing senior ambulance paramedics off the road into the ambulance training centre to work with us in the training programs. So I went out to the air ambulance out at Essendon one day, and I met this dude standing there who was a senior paramedic working out at the air ambulance, and was introduced to this guy, and he said that he was coming in on a secondment into the ambulance training centre, and he would be working with me. And I said, okay, I'll see you when you come in to the centre.
Mm.
So a couple of months later, this guy came in and started working with me, and we worked together for 8 months as work colleagues. And at that time, we were rolling out the training program for intensive care ambulances around the rural setting around Victoria. So we used to do a lot of travelling and a lot of talking in those long drives when you were going out to all the far corners of Victoria to deliver the programs and work with ambos. And we became really, really good mates. And one particular, he'd finished working at the training centre, that's right, and I like to tell this story because it was me that was the silly fool. He asked me, did I want to go for a drink after work? And I thought we were just going, you know, because often the group of people from work would go along and have a drink, so we went along to have a drink, and I asked a few mates along, and I hadn't actually realised that he'd actually asked me to dinner on a date. So
Deborah. Yeah, so the radar wasn't operating.
No, the radar was not working at all. But I do have to say, he got his own back because he was a single dad and he had to pick up his youngest boy. So he nicked off from the date and left me to pay the bill. So I picked up the tab.
So anecdotes aside, so in this period from the time that you didn't marry the fella who...
The first one.
The fella that got spooked. And now meeting Mr... We better give him a name, this fella.
His name's Terry.
And meeting Terry, there were a few fellas came and went. No fellas at all.
Not really. No.
Okay. So
I decided that they weren't worth wasting time on.
So no wonder your radar wasn't working.
And my radar was good when I was around gay guys. I spent a lot of time hanging out with gay people, men and women, not for any other reason except that I had a circle of friends that included quite a few gay people, and I got involved in a lot of activist and gay rights type
Well, there was a lot
activities.
Going on through that time. Yeah.
And I also became very passionate about the whole HIV and AIDS campaign in that time. And in actual fact, in 1991, Andrew and I did a trip to the States because I was going to a midwifery conference, and the people that we stayed with were some gay guys in the gay ghetto within Chicago. And I had the most amazing time in Chicago because I had these great guys showing me around, spent 2 weeks staying with them and had the most fantastic time and became really, really enlightened and aware about the whole HIV and AIDS movement, and what they'd done in America was just the mobilisation of that whole campaign for HIV and AIDS awareness was just extraordinary. fantastic. Yeah. I learned some really incredible strategies around mobilising campaigns and advocacy and lobbying from hanging out in that sort of scene.
Yeah,
so I was pretty happy hanging out with those folk. Mm.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a whole other conversation we could have, but not this day. So then, Terry's arrived. He's got a child and he's left you stuck here with the bill. So the next time that you talk to him, you say, look, I'm terribly sorry, or no, how does that go?
It wasn't quite as simple as that. It was kind of, I didn't actually realise we were on a date until I was telling him about the fact that I was going on a blind date the next night, and he said, well, I hope it doesn't work. And I thought that was pretty mean-spirited for a mate to say to another mate, and that's when the penny finally dropped. And I said, well, and I said to him, when I saw him the next, I think that was the Friday night, I saw him I contacted him on the Monday and said, you skipped off without paying the bill. And he said, well, you didn't even realise that you were on a date. So I said, I think we probably need to have a chat, work out what's going on.
So did the rewind.
Did the bit of rewind. So I said, look, you know, I want to take it a bit slow. You're a single dad. You've got three teenage boys. You know, I'm planning on heading overseas. They seem to have this thing about going overseas and leaving men.
Keeping your distance. But you were clearly interested, and he was.
I thought he was quite a good guy and quite a nice fella.
So we'll set up a few hurdles and a few hoops for him and see.
Yes, I did that along the way. I think I probably did test it for a while.
Yeah, testing a level of commitment.
And all
that sort of stuff. So, and now you've been together for how long?
So we're coming up for our 20th wedding anniversary in April next year.
All right. Mm. And you were married a year or so after you started going out together?
So I think we were mates for about 12 months, and then I think it was about a bit of a rocky road for 15 months or so. He proposed a couple of times, and I didn't think that that's what I wanted, so I said no. Then I decided to go on a holiday with Andrew and his partner, and we were heading off to Bali, and I started sort of seeing Terry again before I went away, and I said, look, you know, I'm going to be in Bali. If you want to come and join me, and we'll sort of see how things go if we're away on holiday, see if we've got a bit of space and time and see how things work out. And I can remember spending a week with Andrew and his partner, and Terry was due to arrive, and we went out to the airport to greet him, and Andrew said to me, you've got to remember, Andrew's known me for quite a while now, and he said to me, so what's going on with this guy, you know, do you think you're in love with him? And I said, oh, you know, what's love? I don't really know what love is, do I? You know, how do I know whether I'm in love with him or not? And Andrew said, well, how are you feeling about seeing him? And I said, oh, you know, I'm pretty excited about seeing him, and, you know, we talked about how I was feeling, and he said, listen, you're heading towards 40. If he proposes to you again, accept. And if it doesn't work out, part, you know. At least you've given it a shot. And I thought, wise words from my dear old friend here. So anyway, not quite as jovial as that. It was quite a lovely holiday. We had a lovely time and we did get on very well. And I was thinking one day, maybe I could see myself with this man. And I thought, on the last day of this holiday, I will propose.
Oh, okay.
And the day before the last day of the holiday, on the spur of the moment, he said, I've only ever said I would ask three times. This is the third time I'm taking a pot shot. Will you marry me? And I said, yeah, I think I will. And so then it was a bit of a whirlwind. We got married very quickly after that.
So not a huge wedding? I didn't do
that. We had a huge wedding. Right. Of course. Yeah. I'm Italian. Yeah, of course. Yeah. So my first marriage, Terry's second, obviously, because he had three boys from his first marriage. And he said, look, you know, whatever happens in life, you only ever have one first wedding. You can have what you want. And Carrie Fisher in Sex and the City actually stole my line. You know, you can only be a bride, a real true bride, up to 40, I think, as the editor of Vogue said in that movie. And so I decided I was going to have the whole shebang, and I did. We had the big wedding, and it was spectacular. Best day of my life.
Yep.
I had six little flower girls and six page boys, and nine of those children I'd been present at their birth.
Oh, wow.
So that was pretty amazing to be able to do that. And we had lots of young people and teenagers involved in our wedding. We had a beautiful reception at a restaurant on the Elwood Beach down in Melbourne. And it was just fantastic. It was just everything that, you know, fantasies are made of and making dreams come true. It was wonderful.
Yeah, fantastic. And obviously very successful.
Well, to date,
so,
yes.
So your working life, you kept on going with the ambulance and then moved...
Yes.
Yeah.
Terry was working back on the road as a paramedic, an intensive care paramedic. He decided to move away from the air wing, and he went back onto the road. And I was still working with the ambulance training centre, and the ambulance training model was about to move into the university sector as well. And long story short, Terry had decided to start doing some remote area work with a company overseas, and he was starting to do some fly-in, fly-out type work. And I happened to see a job advertised for the same company one day based in Jakarta, Indonesia. Mm. I didn't change my name when I got married. Charaza is my name from birth and will be forever. And so I applied for a job in the company, which happened to be the same company that Terry was doing some work for in Indonesia. Another long story short, I got a gig as a manager of clinics in Indonesia. Mm. And so we decided it was now time for the late teenage boys to probably leave home as well.
Yep.
So we left home so that they could run away, and we moved to Jakarta. So Terry was working, took a permanent job working on one of the remote sites, and I took a job working in Jakarta. So we spent 3 years in Indonesia.
And a few times through your career now, you've really made moves because you didn't go to university. Has that ever given you pause? Have you ever had a little pang of regret about that, about not getting a degree? I mean, it's not to say that your life is not fulfilled, but...
I have been back and have received a couple of degrees,
okay.
Done my master's.
All right, okay.
And trying to make an attempt at finishing my thesis for my PhD.
So what drove you back?
For quite some time, I always thought that the measure of intelligence was whether somebody had a degree. So initially it drove me back to prove that that I was as intelligent as other people I knew, other people with a degree. I've now since got a little bit older and a little bit wiser and thought, well, that's actually not the measure of degree. I actually do like learning, but I still have to say I'm not a really good role model as a good student. Mm. I seem to be able to do things minimum effort, but we'll whisper that, not tell too many people,
sure.
Especially not my PhD supervisor.
Yeah.
So, that's right. So,
yeah.
But I do. I have a thirst for learning. I can't learn enough, and I love learning new stuff. I love meeting people. I love hearing about different things. I love the art of storytelling and the absorption of information that you can get. And now, I would love to be able to grow up again and become a computer geek when I grow up. I think the whole revolution of IT and digital space and everything is just amazing. And I would love, if I had my time over again, that's the sort of thing that would be amazing to me.
How long have you been working on the PhD?
Oh, no, I don't want to answer that question.
No.
It's been a while.
Okay.
It's been a while.
Oh, good. Okay. But so
it's been part-time. I've been doing it part-time.
You're quite realistic about the PhD.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. It's very. Good. It's going to be a while.
Okay. So immediately prior to here, you were famously working with the MS Society,
Multiple
is that right?
Sclerosis Australia,
yeah. So, yep. And that was for a few years, isn't it?
Yes, nearly 3 years I was with MSA. That job was an appointment to really start to drive an agenda of setting up a national entity that represented the state societies who cared and delivered services for people with a diagnosis of MS. They had recognised that with the proposal of the National Disability Insurance Scheme that for a Commonwealth-funded project you really need a national entity to represent the organisation. So they had decided and worked on a business plan for some time to establish a national organisation, and I was the first CEO appointed to drive that lobbying and advocacy agenda.
So. And now you're looking to... settle into Apollo Bay?
Well, it seems so, yeah. So that was another one of those, happened to catch up with somebody and they said, we're recruiting a job down at Apollo Bay. And I said, I know my husband would love it down there. He spent many of his early childhood years as doing holidays down at Eastern View, so he knew the Great Ocean Road. And we had quite a few trips down the Great Ocean Road in our courtship, and at various stages along the years that we've been together, we've had holidays down here in Apollo Bay. And so I knew that my contract at MSA was coming up, and I had done what I'd set for myself in that role in the early setup days. So I was looking for my next challenge. Didn't think it would be in Apollo Bay, I have to say. I thought it would be in Melbourne somewhere. And so decided to put in an application, went through the recruitment process, which was quite lengthy, actually. There was four phases to the interview process. And was offered the job and made the decision that I would come down here and give it a shot.
And here you are.
And here I am.
What a great thing. Yeah. So finally, if you could jump in the Back to the Future DeLorean, which has just celebrated its birthday the other day, and go back and tap the young Deborah on the shoulder at some point, either at 18 or 20 or whatever, is there anything you'd say to her?
It's the thing that people often talk about, and it can never happen because it's experience and living life that teaches you that ability to have more confidence in yourself. If I could have the confidence that I have in myself now at the age of 20 and 30...
You'd be Prime Minister.
I think I would have been. In fact, yeah, I would have been. I could have perhaps been the redhead Prime Minister before Julia Gillard was. No, I don't know. I just think that it's that thing about confidence and not being sure, and perhaps there is a few opportunities that I would have taken in a different direction. I don't really know. But having said that, I am really, really glad I became a nurse and a midwife.
Yeah.
I think it's been an incredible career.
Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
This has been What's Your Story with Deborah Chiraza, and you're tuned, logged on to 3ABR.